Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's interview. Today, I have the great pleasure of interviewing John Howard. And John is a couples therapist who's in private practice. And he's an educator who teaches on the new science of relationship. And he is located in Austin, Texas, although as we'll learn in about his work, he also is available in an online format, which I think is very exciting. John has studied with very leading researchers in the areas of neuroscience, also in emotional regulation, and the application of attachment theory to adult partnerships, which is going to be a focus of what we're going to be talking to John about today. He is the founder of the Ready, Set, Love program, which is an online course that supports couples in having an awesome relationship, which, as you already know, having listened to some of my other interviews, that I am deeply committed to couples having an awesome relationship. So I'm very excited to welcome John, who is also a core faculty member at the PACT Institute, which is a training organization for couples therapists. And just to add some of the personal flavor, he's a husband and a father of two small kids. So welcome, 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 John, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rana. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm excited to get into this material.
Excellent. So let's just jump right into it. So, one of the first things I was so interested in reading about your work is the way in which you are integrating neuroscience into your work with couples. So I'd love to hear more about your sense of what modern neuroscience really offers us in terms of how we can strengthen our adult partner relationships.
Sure. Well, as you know, and probably many of your listeners know, neuroscience research from the last 15 years, but particularly the last 5 to 10 years, is changing so many fields of study. It's certainly been changing psychology. It's been changing education, even athletics. And that's because we have new technologies that we can use to study the brain in ways that we never could before. And we're taking what in some cases were theories and ideas and soft science, and we're able to either prove or disprove those ideas using more hard science, being able to see exactly which parts of the brain light up during certain moments, how emotions work in the brain, and so on. So that research has been very interesting, and the part that's most interesting to me is how it relates to understanding relationship and how it can help, average people make their relationship stronger. So there's a few things I would say there. The first is what I like to call the language of the nervous system, which is one thing that we know from neuroscience research is that 90% of partner interactions are actually unconscious to us. What we're aware of is about 10% of the information that's being communicated back and forth. The nervous system, however, is picking up a whole lot more than we're conscious of. And decisions are being made by the nervous system, by parts of the right hemisphere of the brain, the brain stem, and lower parts of the nervous system going into the body. Decisions are being made at those levels, particularly in the areas of safety and security. And as we all know, relationships are one of the areas of our lives where we can often feel under threat. It's so easy to take a comment, the wrong way, or to feel like, maybe someone doesn't like us in a particular way, doesn't accept us in a certain way. So relationships, as wonderful as they are, also make us vulnerable, and so it's easy to feel threatened. And so the language of the nervous system is a way to understand how to communicate to these lower parts of the nervous system so that we can send a clear signal of safety and security to one another in relationship. So we can prevent arguments and prevent misunderstandings by speaking to the more unconscious parts of us. So that's one way that neuroscience can really help people strengthen their relationships.
Great.
And if you'd like, I'm happy to go into more detail as to sort of what the nervous system pays attention to. But I also want to give you a chance to jump in if you have comments and so on.
Well, I'd love, maybe I know we're going to ask sort of like one tool, but like what would be one example maybe of how to help us communicate with our nervous system so that we can help, calm, assuage the sort of those worries about security and safety that, get triggered in relationship. What would be one example of that?
Well, you know, I would say, you know, first, one guiding principle that comes from neuroscience is that we can regulate each other more efficiently than we can regulate ourselves. So, you know, regulating refers to helping us relax, helping us calm down, helping us feel at ease. Another person has more access, in a sense. A relationship can do that more efficiently than we can do for ourselves. So one example of how to use the language of the nervous system is we know the nervous system is paying attention to things like physical closeness, you know, how close somebody is, physical touch, tone of voice, and so on. Words, not so much, except for, you know, some. So an example is, let's say you're speaking to your partner and the conversation gets a little bit stressful, a little bit tense. Well, you can use this understanding of how to speak to the nervous system to move in, for example, rather than continuing to have that conversation at a distance of 3 to 4 feet. At that distance, the brain has to pick up more information, you know, around threat than when it's very in close with somebody. You know, physical touch puts the nervous system at ease. And so when a conversation gets stressful, you know, just stroking your partner's arm or stroking their hair or just holding each other as you talk can really change the course of the conversation.
Hmm. And I would assume in your work with couples that you also then find out what the sort of individual nuances and variations are on that, so that for some people actually the physical touch might do the opposite of what you're saying, and it's sort of about the couple sort of figuring out what are the particular ways in which, you know, the nervous system of that individual responds, or is that...
It's sort of a mix of things, because it's
okay.
True, you know, we're all so unique, and every relationship is also unique, and so I completely agree with you. It's so important for partners to understand, you know, their partner as an individual and not just apply, you know, broad theory, you know, to their partner just because somebody wrote about it. Having said that, however, I encourage the couples I work with to work toward more comfort with the things that seem to communicate closeness across the board, right? So some people are uncomfortable with close eye contact, for example. They didn't grow up with it. They're not accustomed to it. It makes them nervous. So yeah, in the beginning, it's important for partners to be sensitive to each other, you know, not just force eye contact and, you know, give their partner a hard time if they're uncomfortable, but to be sensitive. But at the same time, I also want to see couples developing a little bit more comfort with that kind of intimacy, because over time, I think it does help build the relationship if they can be with each other in a more intimate way.
Yeah. That was a really great point. So it's about sort of like exercising a new muscle in a certain way, or a muscle that they haven't exercised in a long time.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, great. So I'm just curious, do these same principles that you're talking about in relationship to our adult partner relationships, do they also apply to our interactions with our children?
They do. You know, what's neat about the new science of relationship is that it really applies to relationships across the board. So we can use these principles in our relationships with our coworkers, with our friends, with our kids, and with other family members. And with kids, for example, we know that, you know, kids get dysregulated easily because their brains and their nervous systems are still in development. So they don't have, you know, the full range of tools to handle, you know, the emotions and the experiences that come their way. And too often parents, I think, get caught in sort of shaping behavior through discipline rather than understanding the importance of regulation, the importance of really helping the child's nervous system calm down so that they can better take in information and make better choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one example of that is, you know, what's called visceral regulation, which is, you know, the regulation of the viscera, you know, the organs. And, you know, sometimes we think of when kids are having an emotion, we think of just helping them regulate that emotion. But from neuroscience, we know that emotional regulation is dependent on visceral regulation. So if kids are having issues with sleep, you know, if they're tired, if they're not eating well, or their diet is high in sugar and things like that. All of these factors are going to make it much more difficult for them to regulate their emotions because the viscera is not regulated, and that's sort of a precursor to those emotional systems.
Mm-hmm. That's great, yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense that we are, I mean, I think we are very much a culture of, also a culture of talkers. As parents, I think there's a lot of focus on that, and just even going back to what you said earlier about, you know, that 90% of partner interactions, as you said, are unconscious to us. I would imagine that that's very true also of sort of as parents, our interactions with our relationships in general, our interactions with kids, probably a lot happens other than through the sort of, you know, obvious verbal kinds of cues, but that we're not necessarily aware of that. So trying to speak to some of that, so to speak, in nonverbal ways, it sounds like it would be incredibly helpful as a parenting tool.
I think you're so right. You know, often if you ask adults what they remember from a particular interaction, they don't necessarily remember specific words, but they'll often remember what it was like to be with somebody, what the feeling was of being with somebody. And I think kids are even more that way. You know, what they experience, you know, more than anything is the feeling of being with us. And words often, you know, either go over their heads or, you know, they don't really retain them as well. So that nonverbal communication, I think, is really the crux of communicating safety and security.
Okay, great. So that seems like a kind of perfect segue to talking a little bit about attachment theory. And, you know, my sense is that attachment theory is commonly applied to pregnancy and sort of beginning sort of thinking about attachment between mom and gestating child during the pregnancy period and sort of like and immediately postpartum. It's increasingly talked about sort of more as a modality or theory around raising children. So I'd love for you to, and I know that your work also looks at how it relates to adult relationships. So I'd love if maybe we could start with you giving a brief description of attachment theory, both as you understand it and as you use it, and then we can sort of move to relationships from there.
Sure. Well, attachment theory, you know, is a way of understanding how infants and young children develop socially and emotionally based on the experience that they have with their parents and caregivers. And so the research that's been done in that area is fairly conclusive in showing that the quality of the parent-infant pair, the quality of the child-caregiver pair has a dramatic impact on social and emotional development, on the relating qualities that child is going to have, and those extend into adulthood, which we can talk about in a minute. But just sticking, you know, with kids for now, if kids, for example, are left alone too much, you know, to play by themselves, or if they're not given enough support with difficult feelings, and all kids have a lot of challenging feelings because they're just learning about the world, these kids start to rely on themselves a little too much. They go internal, and they seem to then have trouble connecting with others in meaningful ways. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, if a child has inconsistent caregiving, meaning that sometimes it's on, sometimes it's off. Sometimes the parent is really attuned, and then other times the parent is drinking or depressed or going out a lot and is really not there for the child. This kind of inconsistency also has a significant impact. And what it often leads to is a child that seeks closeness because they've had a taste of it, but then they're easily frustrated by it because they can't rely on it. It's a kind of a push-pull dynamic, and that extends also into our adult relationships where people, you know, are seeking a lot of intimacy in their relationships, but then having trouble really enjoying and receiving the intimacy once it's there. So that's sort of an idea of how a child's attachment experience really has a strong effect on the development of their brain, and on their social and emotional learning.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. I mean, I think there's such a, one of the things about attachment theory that I'm always struck by is just how it's just, it sounds so intuitively right.
Yeah.
You know, and I understand there's a long history in terms of research and sort of that there is the proof there, but it just, whenever I hear people talk about attachment theory, it just sounds right. It makes so much sense. Yeah, and then sort of taking it from what you've just said, and you've alluded to sort of the way things then potentially play out in terms of adult relationships, how can attachment theory then be applied to adults more, I'm thinking, as a adult relationship tool so that we're better at our relationships and we can better understand and manage our differences as partners, even if, let's say, our own child, you know, our own childhood attachments were not the healthiest, the most developmentally productive and supportive?
Yeah. Well, this is the beauty of adult relationships, and one reason I love working with adults in their relationships, because relationships have a healing power, you know, when they're done well. Relationships have the potential to really heal some things from the past, you know, calm our fears, reassure us in ways that maybe we didn't get as kids. And so it's so wonderful to have sort of another opportunity to form a bond that's deep enough to access those same areas that we experienced as kids. The stark reality, you know, that we know from neuroscience is that once children get past these critical periods of development, it's a little bit harder to rewire the brain in social and emotional areas. So while an adult relationship can have a tremendous healing impact, typically it's not going to totally alter someone's personality or the way that they tend to relate in relationship. You don't see people change, you know, just become a completely different person, for example. So one way that attachment theory really helps couples as adults is that it gives them an understanding of how to manage differences without having to be completely different people and have different habits, right? So there's an understanding that a lot of these habits are wired in childhood. And, you know, we can move them a little bit, we can improve, but we need a way to understand our differences that isn't just about complaining and criticizing, that doesn't assign too much personal responsibility to certain habits because we know they've been there since childhood, they're hard to change. And at the same time, attachment theory gives us tools to manage those differences much better without just needing them to change. So for example, we know the power of support over criticism. We know the power of a loving and caring environment, that people seem to grow and change more quickly under conditions of love and care than they do under conditions of threat and criticism. So, you know, attachment theory, although it started as a study of children and their caregivers, actually extends and is completely true for adult pairs as well, because it seems to be the same things that really allow kids to thrive and develop that also allow us as adults to heal and grow.
Mm-hmm. And I think so much of what you've just said in the context of attachment theory, I relate to in my work with couples, where the focus is less on explicitly citing attachment theory in terms of how to navigate differences in a more loving way and more using the vocabulary of understanding each other as opposed to agreeing and trying to really, you know, help couples really, I think, at a very deep level, get the difference between understanding and agreeing with.
Yes.
Because I think we often collapse that. So that I want you, you know, I'm different than you. I want you to, I will say to you, I want you to understand my different perspective or different opinion or different experience. But in truth, what I'm really yearning for is for you to agree with me.
Yeah.
And adopt it and mirror it. And I think if we can actually pull apart understanding from agreeing, you know, from a place of compassion, then, you know, that's sort of how I often will work with couples. And I think it's very, very aligned with what you're saying, because so much of it is about saying it's really accepting difference and honoring difference and respecting difference, and I think being compassionate about difference, both our own and those of others, and not trying to change someone, which of course, you know, we I think give lip service to that, but anyone in relationships, I think we many of us struggle with that. But if we can truly get that, you know, get that we're, if not hardwired, then softwired perhaps, using some of the sort of what neuroscience is finding, you know, from childhood, that that allows for a greater room for understanding and acceptance.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's so critical for couples to know the difference and, you know, not put too much pressure on each other to be different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So given everything you just said, which is like sort of, I think, such rich and deep and compelling information, you know, if you were to say, like, what do you think might be the easiest way for couples to get better at their relationship?
Well, what I find in my own practice with couples, and I think this is also a trend in couples' education and training and therapy, is that talking about issues has a limited impact. I think you mentioned this earlier. You know, talking about issues just sort of keeps the conversation at an intellectual level that doesn't really access the parts of us that actually act, you know, when we feel threatened. And so it's very important that couples, I think, focus more on developing skills and practicing those skills than, you know, necessarily just talking, you know, or processing their issues, and that being the only way that they're trying to get better. Couples seem to improve much more rapidly when they're practicing new skills because it brings different forms of memory online. It brings different, you know, types of functioning online in the sense that, you know, we're developing muscle memory attached to the new skill. We're developing an emotional component to doing things differently rather than just, you know, talking about what we're going to do or what we should do. So this idea of skill building, you know, and making relationship growth a little bit more like going to the gym,
yeah,
I think is one way to really improve more rapidly.
Yeah, it's a great sort of shift in perspective, I think, from the way in which a lot of couples, and I would say I think still a lot of practitioners view couples work or, you know, couples education. So I think it's a great shift in perspective. And from that perspective, sort of, you know, you mentioned a number of you know, skill building. What do you think are the most important skills and tools for having a great relationship?
Well, there's a whole host of skills that I think we need to be fluid in the social and emotional area. And so going back to attachment theory, you know, some of those we might have gotten as kids if our parents were really good, you know, at being open-minded and flexible and caring and attuned. And some of those things we didn't get, you know, if we had to put ourselves to sleep every night, if we had to deal with a middle school bully on our own. You know, then we have some areas where perhaps social and emotional relating aren't as familiar to us, right? We get into a certain feeling and we isolate with it. We don't talk about it. We don't know how to resource somebody else. So there's so many skills, you know, that we need. But they all sort of tend to show up when we start practicing being closer to one another, creating a more secure base in our relationship. So as an example, I think that a flexible mind, for example, is a really important tool to building security in a relationship. Do we have the ability to hold two different opinions as equally valid? Do we have the ability to put ourselves truly in another person's shoes and see the world from their perspective?
Yes.
This is hard for a lot of folks because maybe our family wasn't very good at doing that, or we were pressured to see things a certain way, so then we get used to pressuring other people. And obviously we see the effects of this in our political system, where people are having a heck of a time, you know, speaking respectfully with one another and finding common ground. So it's the same skill in adult relationship that I think can make a really big difference. And there's ways to practice developing more fluidity and flexibility in our minds. You know, for example, sitting with our partners and really bringing something to the forefront that is a difference of opinion, and then really training ourselves to see it from both sides and see both as equal. Exercises like that, I think, can really help us.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's a wonderful exercise that I was taught as part of my training in relationship systems integration called Land's Work, and the conceit behind it is to imagine that we are each tourists and sort of ideal tourists, meaning tourists that come from a place of curiosity and openness and flexibility and the absence of judgment, and to imagine that each person is a nation unto him or herself with our own cultural practices, our own codes of conduct, our own judicial system, our own border guards, our own, you know, national cuisine, and, you know, our own flag, our own, you know, ways of dressing, and to imagine that we then become a tourist in someone else's nation, and to come from that ideal tourist perspective, and to try and get curious about, well, how do things work in your country? And it's an incredible, you know, it's very much along the lines of what you're describing, sort of how do we have that, it's very much about how do we cultivate and practice a flexible mind and what might be a kind of structure or exercise or model to help us practice that. So I think, you know, Land's Work, which I was trained in and helped couples with, becomes a perfect illustration of flexible mind in a way to cultivate flexible mind as you're describing it.
It's such a great metaphor. I mean, I love, you know, the idea of thinking about ourselves as nations, you know, with our own food and our own customs and our own flag and so on. It's such a great metaphor because I think it's accurate. And if we can think of, you know, merging, I mean, relationship is a merging process. So how do two separate nations really merge and form common ground while still respecting these differences?
Absolutely.
There's something
else in the context. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, there's something else that comes to mind for me, too, which is, you know, we say that one of the hallmarks of a secure relationship is that each person is thinking about what's good for both rather than what's good for me. You know, so I think we all understand that as a concept, but, you know, when the rubber meets the road, you know, do we really think about what's good for you and me?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I get caught, you know, thinking about what's good for me and I'm not really thinking about what's good for you? And so this is another sort of critical skill, you know, really important skill that couples need to practice if they're not, you know, naturally in the habit, which many of us aren't, which is always keeping in mind that question of, you know, is what we're doing good for you and me? Or is there a winner and a loser here? And, you know, if there's ever a loser, there's got to be a different solution that a couple looks for.
That's a great, I mean, great, great question to ask, to always be asking ourselves, especially when I think a couple is in, you know, when we're struggling with a partner, sort of is there a winner or a loser, or when a decision is being made or a compromise is being made, right? I think compromise is always one of those questions or words that we talk about. Yeah, we want to reach a compromise. And unfortunately, I think a lot of times what we get is something called, you know, that I like to call compromise with resentment, which is not really what we're trying to work towards. So, and I think that, you know, this notion of is there a winner or a loser here is a great way to try and get to what I try and work with couples on, which is compromise without resentment, right? That this is sort of compromise from that place, I think a place that, you know, where there is a consideration of us, as you're suggesting. What you were talking about also, I wanted to tell you that sort of in that Land's Work exercise, in the end, you know, you talked about, you know, the relationship is a merging, sort of a romantic relationship, especially is a merging kind of experience. And one of the things I love, love, love about that exercise is that in the end, there is still your land and my land. And the goal is then to create a kind of third entity, which is our land.
Mm.
And our land does not get rid of yours or mine. It's not like our individuality disappears, but in order for us to be in fulfilled relationship with each other, we need to also figure out the us. And in my training, when I work with couples, I coach their relationship. right? It's not about working, you know, I'm not working with you and you. It's the relationship that you two create together, and how do we work with the us? How do we better get to know it and understand what it needs and wants and is calling forth in both of you individually, as opposed to that power struggle, which is so often where so many of us get stuck and return to when we're under stress and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to think about it. you know, one of my mentors, Dr. Stan Takin, who wrote Wired for Love, he talks just like you mentioned, you know, that compromise can often breed resentment. He talks about the difference between compromise and negotiation, and how
yeah.
compromise can sometimes leave both people feeling like they got half of what they wanted.
Yes.
And then we live in this sort of gray area where life isn't really that awesome anymore. And to replace that idea with more of an idea of negotiation, which really respects individuality, but is also looking for that common ground where it's mutually beneficial. And so if people are, you know, willing to sort of negotiate for what they really want, you know, while at the same time doing the same for their partner, then there's less of a tendency to end up with something that's, you know, not that exciting to anybody.
Yes, yes. And then, you know, I think when it is a true negotiation where the us is considered, or where, you know, sometimes we are considering the other person as an individual and not necessarily only our relationship together, we could still be coming up with a scenario where I end up with just like 10% of what I wanted, and you might end up with 90%, or maybe I'll end up with 0%, and
yeah.
you'll end up with 100%. But if we truly negotiate, if we truly, you know, I guess in my language, compromise without resentment, use that kind of tool,
yeah.
then we're okay with the outcome.
Yeah.
We're at choice. It's conscious, intentional choice. We are, you know, we are not walking around with that resentment and disappointment and, you know, those buried feelings that always end up erupting somewhere else.
Yeah, for example, you know, I think a classic example is, let's say you have one partner who likes to stay in, they're more introverted, they're a little more shy, and you have one partner who's very outgoing, very extroverted, they like to go to a lot of parties and so on. You know, so a compromise might be something like, well, you know, let's go to the party for half the time, but then, you know, let's come home early. And so we can have dinner together, and, you know, neither partner is really that excited about, you know, doing either thing.
Right.
Versus a negotiation might be something more like, you know, tonight let's I'll go out with you tonight, and we'll stay at the party, and I'll do that with you, and let's go out and have a good time, and I'll put up with it as best I can, you know, but we'll do it. But tomorrow night let's stay in, you know, and let's just be together, and let's just have a nice night together tomorrow. Giving more of what each person really wants in terms of the full experience.
Yeah. Yeah, really great point. Really great point. So that's, you know, as we're talking, I'm very, very curious for you, when do you think it's important for couples to seek help from a professional? Like, what are the kinds of struggles or challenges or signs in a relationship that are like, oh, this is a red flag. We need some help.
Well, the thing we always worry about is when couples allow negative feelings to hang out for a long period of time. That seems to do the most damage, is the length of time that people are willing to tolerate feeling negatively toward each other. In the research, it's very well documented that couples typically seek counseling too late to have, you know, the best impact on their issues. So Europe seems to do a better job in that area. Couples seek help sooner. I think we could do a better job here in the United States in terms of, you know, couples recognizing when their arguments aren't being resolved effectively, mm-hmm. when, you know, they sort of have a ceasefire, but they continue to have negative feelings about the relationship. Catching that earlier in the process where, you know, a professional that's trained in how to help couples can really make a difference at that point. You know, once couples have been living that way for years, it becomes a little bit harder because a lot of experience goes into long-term memory. And then there's a lot of other parts of our mind that need to switch gears. There's also, you know, I mean, just to put a plug in here for there's a range of options that couples can use to seek support. So, you know, a couple's therapist or a couple's counselor, I think, is appropriate when the issues are complicated and challenging and sticky. You know, I think there are a lot of people who work with couples in a very competent manner that can offer all kinds of services and range and, you know, types of options. For example, I know you yourself do a fair amount of coaching online. And I think that's a tremendous resource for people because maybe they don't want to go see somebody in their local area, or maybe they live in an area where they don't, you know, have confidence in the people they could work with there. You know, a lot of people are on the move, they're traveling, they're on the go. So I think life coaches, you know, people who offer, you know, coaching sessions online, couples therapists, and I also think couples workshops. I was talking with someone today about this, that there's all these fantastic couples workshops that are happening around the country at retreat centers and personal growth centers, and I'm sure even in local communities, you know, churches and counseling centers and so on. And, you know, going to these workshops is sort of nice because you're there with other couples. You get to hear people talking about the same issues. You get an inspirational message that sort of helps you have hope and move forward. So I think there's a lot of ways to seek support. But certainly, you know, I think generally people should seek it sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. Very good advice. One of the things I just want to sort of jump in a slightly tangent on what you were saying about specifically on the topic of couples workshops and the importance, I think, of that kind of experience for parents especially. I remember I was on a panel at a Parent Map conference in Seattle, and Parent Map is a parent magazine and a family magazine in Seattle, and I was on a panel there a few years ago, and Dr. Stephanie Kuntz, who is a family researcher, family historian, I guess, was talking about how research shows that couples who do couples workshops together, compared to parents who do parenting workshops together, the ones who did workshops that were focused on improving their relationship skills and their relationship tools actually showed a greater increase in competency around parenting than those who actually just took the parenting workshop. So that it was the couples work, the relationship work, that actually had a greater positive impact on those same couples' parenting than had they gone to a parenting-focused workshop. And I think that sounds very right from the research that I know and from my work with couples who are parents. And I just, you know, it was very compelling for me to hear that from Dr. Kuntz.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, actually, because I think that's maybe one of the most important messages we can give to parents and to couples with kids. Because, you know, even in the attachment parenting community, for example, where parents are being very conscious about how they're raising their kids, making sure that development is optimized and so on, there's often a neglect of the adult relationship in that process. And sometimes people don't realize that attachment is something that needs to, you know, be occurring in the entire system as a whole, and it needs to be modeled, you know, by the adults. Kids are not just learning, you know, from their experience with their caregivers, but they're learning a whole heck of a lot by watching how the adults in their lives interact with other adults. In fact, when kids grow up and start to have their own adult relationships, often the map that is sometimes even more significant than how we were treated directly is what we saw in our home.
Absolutely.
You know, and this is not just, you know, for couples with kids. I mean, it also applies to single parents with kids.
Yes.
Because kids are watching to see, you know, where does that single parent get their support from? How do they, you know, get help and resources? Are they relying on me as the kid for that, or do they have other adults in their lives that they can resource? And what do those relationships look like? Because that tells kids something about relationship when it's between equals.
Yes.
And that's different than the relationship between a parent and a child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think also sort of one of the aspects of what you just described that I'm especially interested in, just because very often this is what shows up when couples come to me to work with me, and I suspect this is also true of you, given what we were talking about, that, you know, in the States, there's unfortunately couples really wait a long time before they seek help. There's a lot of negativity that piles up before they seek help. Is, you know, how to learn how to do conflict productively. Like, what is it, you know, the phrase that I use is, like, how do we learn how to fight right, fight productively, fight constructively, and how do we model that for our children? And so when you said that very often what's going on with couples, you know, when couples, you know, might benefit from seeking help from a professional, it's because they're, you know, that you said that they're, you know, a lot of unresolved fights. And the research really shows, and a lot of this research actually comes from divorce research and the impact of divorce on children, is that, you know, the issue is not the most negative impact, I think, is not necessarily conflict per se. Conflict's a part of relationships. This is, you know, we cannot avoid conflict. It's how we do conflict, and that an incredibly destructive thing for both relationships as well as for our children watching us, their parents in relationship, is for them to witness unresolved conflict, conflict that never gets resolved. And resolution can take many, many forms. It can be an agreement to disagree. It's not like we have to get on the same page with a conflict. But the research really shows that if kids can witness parents or adults, probably in general, important adults to them, modeling the resolution of conflict, that they then learn those tools. And learning how to do conflict, I think, is a crucial component of how to be productively in relationship with someone else.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, all couples fight and argue. Healthy couples argue. And that doesn't seem to be a problem if the partners know how to repair things quickly and get back on track feeling good toward each other. And also, one thing we know from neuroscience research is that timing really matters a whole lot. In other words, we can do the right thing a day too late, and that argument, that fight, is already stored in long-term memory and will resurface, you know, next year or the year after that. And so, you know, also remembering that when we argue, when we fight, you know, we want to repair that as quickly as possible. And when kids witness that, it really is an experience that changes their own relationships. For example, I often ask partners I work with, did you ever see your parents apologize to each other?
Mm-hmm.
And many people say no.
Yeah.
You know, I saw them fight, I saw them argue, I never saw them apologize to each other. So it's very powerful for kids, you know, when they see adults disagreeing and then they see the repair.
Yes.
But like you said, it really teaches them something important about what goes into a secure relationship, and it's not just the absence of arguing.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, and I'm also glad you mentioned timing, because I know I take John Gottman's work as sort of my model in terms of when I work with couples, which is what he says is the importance of trying to do that repair within 24 hours.
Yeah.
That if we let it go longer than that, it really then does become that sort of, you know, it tests the limits of our ability to resolve, and it becomes that more unconscious resentment that we hold and that lingers. So, I'm just aware of time, so I want to, you know, maybe just the last couple of questions, if you have time for them.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So I'd love if you could maybe give us one exercise that you use with the couples with whom you work that you think can make a difference in you know, our listeners' lives and relationships.
Well, a basic exercise that I also think is extremely powerful comes from Dr. Stantec, and who I mentioned earlier. I think it's in his Wired for Love book. He also has a great audio series called Your Brain on Love, if people like to listen, you know, to CDs or audio files. But it's a very simple exercise, and it's called the Welcome Home exercise. And the way this works is whenever two partners have been apart for a good part of the day, you know, let's say one was at home, one was at work, or they both went off to work, they haven't seen each other, that the very first thing they do upon reunion is they do a belly-to-belly hug, and they hold it. And this is before any words are spoken. They embrace, they hold it, and what you're waiting for in that embrace is you're waiting to feel the body of your partner sort of drop and relax. You know, you're waiting to hear a sigh, some sign that they've sort of relaxed into your arms, and you've done the same with them. And it's at that point then that people can start asking, you know, how was the day, what happened, or at that point you would greet other family members like the dog or the kids. And the reason that this exercise is so powerful is because we have a crazy amount of neurons in the gut that are part of the system that communicates safety and security. And when partners engage in a belly-to-belly hug and they hold it long enough, there seems to be this syncing effect where their nervous systems are actually syncing up with each other, you know, in the same way that we sync our iPod or you know, a tablet. And so this communicates to the lower level nervous system of both partners that, hey, we're together, you know, we're a unit, we're here for each other, we're connected. It often helps prevent arguments. It's a great way to connect. And, you know, family members, you know, try to get in on it and so on, that's fine. But it's really important for partners to prioritize each other in that moment and send a very clear signal that we are the go-to people for each other. You know, we manage the household. We have to be connected first. And that's one I've seen make a big difference in people's lives.
I love it. That's great, simple, speaking to that visceral stuff that you're, you know, the visceral connection you were talking about earlier, communication. That's great. Beautiful. Thank you.
Sure.
So, and now as we wind up this interview, I'd love for you to tell us how our listeners and readers can stay connected to you and learn more about your work and what they can learn and how they can improve their relationships through you and your work.
Well, I've started a relationship education company called Ready, Set, Love. And what we're trying to do is sort of help fill the gap, as you are, you know, in giving people tools and skills that are really critical for creating secure, fun, exciting, you know, fulfilling relationships, because we all know that schools don't really teach us or prepare us very much for that part of our lives. Often our families didn't model it, or, you know, we can't take a lot of examples from that. So people don't have a place to learn it unless they're actively seeking training and education. And I wanted to take this new science of relationship and all the incredible tools that are coming from that research and adapt it to an online program that couples can do from home. So your listeners can go to readysetlove.com. They can sign up for free to my online newsletter. They can start to get tips right away. And they can eventually sign up for the online program. Currently, we have it as a 12-month program. And the nice thing about that is that it's very comprehensive, and I take people through all the themes of a healthy relationship, and I do some skill-building exercises and some integration work and so on. So I would recommend that program to anybody who sort of wants a way to strengthen their relationship from the privacy and comfort of their own home. And we're going to be adding other programs as we go. But they can access all the information on our website at readysetlove.com.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that information and just for sharing this wealth of just great insights and knowledge and ideas and tools with me and with our listeners and readers today. This has been a really wonderful experience. So thank you so much, John.
You're welcome. And I really appreciate, you know, just having this time to spend with you and listening to your perspective and, you know, how much common ground we have in the way we work. So thank you very much for the interview.
Absolutely. Thank you.